It is my pleasure, though, to welcome our distinguished guest who will be speaking about the question of religious freedom. And I'm really happy to have David here join us. We're old friends, and he started his graduate career in the same place as me at the University of Chicago, then went on to Princeton to finish his PhD. And I'll read his bio for you to give you a little background of what he's been up to since then. Professor David DeCosimo works in theology, ethics, religion, and politics, and philosophy, and the theory of religion, focusing especially on Christianity and Islam, and on philosophical, theological, and theoretical questions surrounding relations among Christians, Muslims, Jews, and atheists. He has particular interest in pre-modern texts and figures, both on their own terms and as a resource for philosophical and theological work that offers religious believers and non-believers alike new ways of imagining their relations to one another and fresh responses to the political and ethical challenges they face. Central to his teaching and research is an effort to show how tradition and liberation can go hand in hand. His first book, Ethics as a Work of Charity, Thomas Aquinas and Pagan Virtue, examines Aquinas' account of whether non-Christians can lead virtuous lives, offering a reinterpretation of Thomas's moral theology and a synthesis of philosophy and theology. His second book, Four Tasks of Christian Ethics, is that out yet?
No, it's under review at the moment.
All right, good. Congratulations. It's in the can, almost out, on its way. Offers a new way of understanding the history and work of Christian ethics and an account of how and why that work so often goes awry. Prior to joining Boston University's Faculty of Theology 3 years ago, he served on the faculty at Loyola University in Maryland. His talk today is entitled, What's Wrong with the New Genealogy of Religious Freedom? Welcome, David. We're delighted you're here.
Thank you, and thank you so much, Eric, and to the Boise Center for inviting me. I remain always surprised and honored that anyone wants to hear something that I have to say, and grateful for it, and thank you for this opportunity. And I think back very fondly to Eric as this figure much further in his education than I was at the University of Chicago, and being able to get great advice from him and learn from him. And so it's a real pleasure to be here. And thanks to all of y'all for coming on such a beautiful and unusually mild November Boston day. So it's a delight to be here. What I want to do in the time we have here is to do something like giving you a snapshot of a snapshot. That is, I'm going to give you a little taste of a bigger article of mine that's dealing with these issues of religious freedom and understandings of it that we'll talk about. And that article itself is part of a bigger project that's tentatively entitled No Lord But God, Domination and Freedom in Christianity and Islam. And one of the issues at the heart of that bigger project is this idea, which will emerge a little bit as I try to unpack the set of ideas that I want to get into today. It's this idea. A great number of, let's call them liberal theorists, have thought of religion and religious commitment as in some way dangerous to the democratic or the liberal project. And so one piece of intellectual labor they've had to take up is to try to figure out how to make religion safe for democracy or for pluralism or for liberalism. On the other hand, and this will be our focus today, a group of critical theorists who take their cues from Friedrich Nietzsche and Michel Foucault want to tell a very different story. They see the tale told by liberal theorists about the danger of religion as the worst sort of sleight of hand. And what they want to argue is that this liberal project is itself simply one more tradition alongside others, only it seeks to exert its dominance over all of the rest. And they see, instead of seeing religion as threatening liberalism, they see liberalism and its ideals of freedom as threatening religion. And part of what these end up having in common, these two very different and opposed constituencies, is this conviction that religion and freedom are fundamentally incompatible in some sense. Now, for the liberals, this is a problem with religion. For these critics, who I'll call the new genealogists, this is a problem with freedom. That is, so much, they say, so much the worse for freedom that it is incompatible with religion, because freedom itself is just a dangerous and insidious ideology. And part of what I'm trying to do big picture-wise, and I'm not really going to be getting into this that much today, but we can maybe in the Q&A, what I'm trying to do big picture-wise is to open up the space for us to hear what religious traditions might have to teach us about what freedom means and what freedom is. And it shouldn't be so surprising to us to think that they might have something to teach us. Because if we look over the past two centuries at some of the most important broad-based movements for increasing and expanding the scope of liberty, in a great many of these, from the abolition projects in England and the United States to anti-apartheid movements in South Africa to movements for home rule in India, the work of religious traditions has figured in essential and prominent ways in gaining and purchasing the expansion of liberty for people who prior to that did not enjoy it. So it would make sense that we might have something to learn from these traditions about what it might mean to prize and realize freedom. So that's the big picture. But today, I just want to walk through one small step in this overarching argument by talking about this group of scholars or this movement that I call the New Genealogy of Religious Freedom. And we're going to move in four basic steps. I'm going to quickly introduce what this movement is. Then I'm going to articulate what their critique of religious freedom is. Then in the third step, I'm going to give us a sense of the assumptions that are underlying their critique. And it turns out that if we reject those assumptions, then with them, we can put aside the critique, or at least we can recognize the critique as targeting something very particular and not targeting religious freedom more generally, or freedom more generally. And then at the end, in sort of a fourth step, and I don't think we'll have time to make a lot of headway in this, I'll at least gesture toward an alternative vision of religious freedom to that the new genealogists attack and that their liberal opponents endorse. All right, so those are the four basic steps. So first off, what is the new genealogy of religious freedom? And because I want to be mindful of the time, I'll be looking down here. It's not because I'm checking for text or baseball scores. So what is the new genealogy of religious freedom? It's a scholarly movement and mood that is, as I mentioned before, informed by the critical theories of Nietzsche and Foucault, among others. And it's a movement that looks especially toward the important anthropologist and influential scholar of religion, Talal Asad. And near the heart of this kind of critical theory is an effort to unveil or unmask prized ideals that inform our lives and to show the ways in which these ideals are either insidious or self-contradictory or otherwise problematic. So you can think famously of Nietzsche in On the Genealogy of Morals, trying to show that Christian ideals of love are actually animated by deep hatred and ressentiment, a resentment, a desire to turn the table on the oppressor. And this impulse, this genealogical impulse, is at the heart of this movement that I call the New Genealogy of Religious Freedom. And most simply, their basic claim is this: religious freedom is bad, very bad. Or as one of my teenage cousins would say, religious freedom is the worst. Religious freedom, far from being an ideal we ought to cherish or seek to realize in our political lives, is instead something we should regard with the utmost suspicion. Now, this group of scholars includes, and here we may want to kind of pass these books around, this group of scholars includes most prominently Winifred Fowler Sullivan, Sabah Mahmood, Elizabeth Shackman Hurd, and Peter Danchin. And funded by over $1 million in the form of two different grants, they've undertaken what they have called the Politics of Religious Freedom Project. This has resulted in the production of multiple monographs, one of which by Mahmood, I think. Is that the one?
That's Winnie Sullivan's there.
Or no, the one below it.
That's Elizabeth.
Shackman Hurd, yeah. And it's produced several monographs. It's produced a very influential edited volume. It has sponsored postdoc scholars, international conferences, the development of syllabi. So by any measure, it's an important new movement on the scene. That being said, the claims of any one of those particular figures when it comes to these topics are very complex and difficult sometimes. It's difficult sometimes to ferret out exactly what they are and are not meaning to commit themselves to. And so in that case, I found it helpful to construct what scholars call an ideal type. That is a sort of idealized, abstracted version that seeks to capture the claims that seem to be shared and common among these figures. But I don't want to make the further claim of assigning this view to any one of these figures. And in fact, part of what I'm hoping is that in publishing this, it will invite these figures who spark such important conversations to clarify where each of them stands on the various issues that I'm going to articulate and raise. Now, that then is the basic idea of what the New Genealogy of Religious Freedom is. I want to turn now to just what its critique of religious freedom actually is. And this is on the handout, but there's basically five basic criticisms. In the first place, religious freedom, on their view, is incoherent or impossible. And one of the books that's circulating is Winnie Sullivan's book, the title of which is The Impossibility of Religious Freedom. And the basic thesis of that book is that religious freedom is impossible. Now, this claim that religious freedom is impossible or incoherent has a number of different sources. One important one is something like this: so much as to try to protect religious freedom involves the government in deciding on and pronouncing about just what exactly constitutes religion. But if freedom is about non-interference by the government, then that very act of deciding just what is and is not religion is itself a violation of freedom. That's one version of the argument they make. Another is that it is much more straightforward, that if we look at any number of actual cases, we'll find that religious freedom is rarely, if ever, honored in the courts. Now, that's an empirical claim. I don't think it withstands much scrutiny, but it's one that has been important as they have tried to make their claims about the impossibility or the incoherence of religious freedom. So the first critique, that religious freedom is impossible. It's silly to think that it's something we could achieve. The second claim is this, that religious freedom is systematically biased. And here I want to read you a particular quote. Freedom, religious freedom, necessarily involves dividing legal from illegal religion, good religion from bad religion, along an ongoing set of dichotomies, individual or communal, private or public, spiritual or material, belief or practice, chosen or given, Western or Eastern, peaceful or violent, utopian or locative, universal or particular. The basic claim in their claim that religious freedom is inherently biased is that embedded in the ideal and pursuit of religion, of religious freedom, is a certain conception of what it is to be a religious subject or what a religion is, and that this conception is a kind of narrow form of liberal Protestantism through and through. So that only insofar as you as a religious actor or your religious tradition resembles a very narrow form of belief-centric, hyper-individualized liberal Protestantism, does your freedom actually get registered or fall in for protection? And that again and again they say the system works in a way that favors this particular sort of religion and privileges it over other religions, let alone other over non-religious individuals and communities. So the system is rigged in favor of something like Tillichian, Paul Tillich's brand of liberal Protestantism. So that's the systematic bias critique. But they go further than this. Their third claim, and I want to be clear that these critiques, they don't have this nice handy list of five critiques. This is involved synthesizing and constructing an ideal type, and you can see the kinds of claims reflected on this handout and in the published version of this article in much more detail than probably any of us are interested in, the where this is coming from. But their third claim, or the third claim of the new genealogy, is that religious freedom is a tool of protection. A tool of oppression. It's a technique of exerting state power, and it's a technique by which the state reaches more deeply into individual lives and communities to exert control, to draw boundaries, to establish itself as the one and only source of power and authority. So religious freedom, instead of being something that frees, is in fact something that oppresses. And here there's sort of an ironic, and I just as I was thinking about talking about this morning, I hadn't thought of this before, there's an ironic intersection here between this critical theory and Ronald Reagan's famous sentence, that the scariest sentence in the English language is, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." That is, they both have this idea, this deep, rooted in very different things, this deep suspicion of state power. And they see religious freedom as yet another dangerous and insidious face of state power by which the state would oppress individuals and communities. But it goes further than this. Religious freedom is ideology. What ideology is, in part, or on one conception, is a set of doctrines whereby those who embrace those doctrines come to believe false things about their own status or about their community or about what's going on. And so that the person who's in the grip of ideology is her own imprisoner, her own worst enemy. And so in this case, as they see it, religious freedom is an ideology insofar as communities are lured to articulate their claims in the language of religious freedom. And yet in doing so, they deepen the power of the state over their lives. And so religious freedom is ideological in the sense that it promises freedom, but it actually delivers domination, and it makes those who pursue it and lift it up their own prisoners. Now, all of this is a pretty negative portrait of religious freedom, I think we might say. But more than this is this final claim, which unites all of them and is both implicit in them, but it's actually explicitly articulated as well. And it's the claim that this is what religious freedom essentially is. This is the only way that religious freedom exists and is realized. So much so that to endorse or pursue any brand of religious freedom is necessarily to get entangled in precisely these problems that they lay out. And you can see a few examples of this perspective again on the handout. Now, I don't have as much time as I would hope, but I want to quickly try to hit on a few other points or of the main points. So with this final critique, this claim that this is what religious freedom essentially is, we move into the sort of third step of the argument, namely the assumptions that are underlying this critique. And the most important assumption is that there is something called the very idea of religious freedom. Namely, there is something that is religious freedom essentially, and it is marked in just these ways. But this is an assumption that I think we can probably all realize relatively quickly is relatively problematic. There are a lot of different ways of thinking about what freedom is. There are a lot of different ways of thinking about what religions are. There are a lot of different ways of holding those two concepts together. And then once we're holding those together, there are a lot of different ways in which we together as a political community could seek to implement and deliver and realize that conception of religious freedom that we've settled on. And so the idea that there is something called the very idea of religious freedom or the essence of religious freedom is not an idea that has much, if anything, with which to commend it to us and to cause us to endorse it. And if we don't take on board that particular, if we don't understand religious freedom in as this essentialized sort of thing and marked in this essential way, then the story can quickly become quite different. And in particular, I see three further assumptions that are underlying the conception of religious freedom that they are critiquing and that they are mistaking, in my view, for religious freedom as such. There's assumptions about freedom, assumptions about neutrality, and assumptions about power. They're assuming that freedom is non-interference. It's the capacity to maximize our choices so that freedom is violated just when government or anything else interferes in our capacity to make choices. They're assuming that neutrality is something like the absolutely objective and pure adjudication of any competing claims, or that neutrality is something founded on an ideal of reason with a capital R, or something that is founded on doctrines that no reasonable person could reasonably reject. In other words, they're assuming that for something to count as neutral, it has to realize ideals of objectivity that somehow touch on the nature of reason, maybe a version of natural law, some ideal that lifts us out of our particularity and our situatedness. And then finally, they're assuming that power, or at least state power, is only and exclusively a force for domination and oppression. Now, the first of these two assumptions, the assumption that freedom is non-interference and that neutrality needs to be vindicated by reasons no reasonable person could reasonably reject, these two assumptions are assumptions that actually are endorsed and shared by their foundationalist opponents. That is, the new genealogists haven't made up this vision of religious freedom from thin air. Rather, they're responding to a particular liberal vision of what religious freedom is that finds its root in the work of Immanuel Kant and more recently in the work of John Rawls. And they detect in that vision of religious freedom deep problems in the following ways. On the one hand, if you do conceive of freedom as non-interference, then you're gonna regard families, religious communities, and all sorts of other relationships or collectivities as dangerous and threatening to freedom. So Thanksgiving is coming up, right? Families are nothing if not full of interference. They're full of people interfering in our lives. Being a parent is a high interference relationship. Being part of a synagogue or a mosque or a church, these are high interference sorts of relationships. And if freedom is about non-interference, and if the job of the state is to promote freedom, then the job of the state is in a certain way to neutralize, isolate, or minimize the presence of those kinds of relationships and communities. The new genealogists see this oppressive dimension within foundationalist visions of freedom. And so they rightly resist it. Likewise, they see the way in which appeals to that which no reasonable person could reasonably reject always encode particular ideals of who a rational agent is that themselves are being rendered immune from critique, immune from criticism, and immune from further investigation. And so they call the bluff on the brand of objectivity and neutrality endorsed by foundationalist proponents of religious freedom. Now, these two assumptions are shared by foundationalist proponents and new genealogical critics. One assumption that distinguishes the new genealogists from the foundationalists is the idea that state power is necessarily oppressive or dominative. And I don't think we have good reason to think that. I think that, and we can talk about this more in the QA, and I'll wrap things up here. If we look at the legacy of state power, it is a mixed bag. And there are many clear cases, though, where state power has been effective and necessary in protecting oppressed minorities of various sorts. So the way forward, to conclude, is to reject these assumptions about freedom, about neutrality, and about power, and to articulate a different vision of religious freedom that doesn't share what's held in common by these conflicting parties. The foundationalists are right that there's something worth caring about called religious freedom. And they're right that political communities can help in achieving it. But they're wrong to conceive religious freedom in the particular foundationalist way that they do. On the other hand, the new genealogists are right that foundationalist religious freedom is ideological, is oppressive, is often a tool of domination. But they're wrong to think that foundationalist religious freedom is the only sort of religious freedom that we could have or that we ought to care about. So with that, I'll conclude, having gone a few minutes over, but hopefully awesome. We still have plenty of time for a discussion.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Great.